are going to do an overview of the book of Daniel tonight. Felt like that would be appropriate as we prepare our hearts and our minds to jump into the book of Revelation on Sunday. And I want to encourage you, even if you have been through the book of Revelation, if it's something you want to learn, you want to grow in, get some type of notebook and bring it to church and write Revelation on the top of the first page and just get ready to take some notes. And by the time you're done, you will have your own commentary of the book of Revelation in your own notes, the things that touched your heart, the things that God spoke to you. It'd be very, very powerful exercise, so to speak. So there's that little challenge. So turn in your Bibles to the Old Testament book of Daniel. Now, I want to say as we get going, I'll have some charts that we'll be looking at. I have some slides, and I put it all on a handy-dandy piece of paper. And after service, when you leave, you can pick it up in the foyer from Mr. Lee, okay? Lee will get that for you. Brother Lee, I should say. Brother Lee. So there is that. Daniel, what an amazing book. If we call the book of Genesis where we see God as the God of creation, in Daniel, we see God as the God of history. We see God as the God of history. And I like doing these one sentence, sort of high level, condensed views of overviews like these, because it just gets us a crystallized understanding of what the book is all about. So here's what Daniel is all about. Daniel, who was carried off to captivity as a teenager, becomes a high-ranking and very wise official in the Babylonian and Persian empires, having and interpreting prophetic visions concerning the future of Israel and Gentile kingdoms. So that's really what Daniel is all about. We see Jesus in every book of the Bible, don't we? Every book of the Bible, every page of the Bible, it's all about him. It's all about Jesus. Jesus is the stone that will crush the kingdoms of the world in chapter 2. He's the fourth man in the fiery furnace in chapter 3. He's the Son of Man, giving everlasting dominion, glory, and eternal kingdom that will never be destroyed in chapter 7. So that's big picture of what we're going to see tonight. The book of Daniel was written by, guess who? Daniel. That's right. Even the book of Daniel claims to be written by Daniel himself. And although sometimes, or maybe more often than not, the book is written in the third person, and then there's only a handful of times that Daniel speaks in the first person. And that's customary for ancient writers to speak in that way about themselves. And then the one exception to that in the Old Testament is Nehemiah. Nehemiah, because he wrote that book as sort of a diary of his experiences at that time. And we know that even God switches from the first and third person when speaking of himself. So you look at Exodus 20, verse 2, he says, I am the Lord your God. But then in Exodus 20, verse 7, he says, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless. And then he goes on. So the Lord switches back and forth. So it must be okay. But what I take away from this regarding the authorship of Daniel, ultimately it's the Holy Spirit. But the human author, Jesus puts to rest, because he says in Matthew 24, 15 and Mark 13, 14, he said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and then he goes on. So Jesus tells us that Daniel wrote the book of Daniel. Does that settle it for you? It should. This is written to the Jewish exiles, of course, and God's people everywhere. The main characters of this book, you've got Daniel, and then he had three friends that we'll talk about, right? Their pagan names are probably more familiar than their God-given names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then we've got Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, Cyrus, and Belshazzar. Daniel was written before 530 BC. covers a span of history from around 605 BC and the first Babylonian invasion of Israel, when he and many notable people and rulers and trained young men were carried off. So Daniel ministered during the entire Babylonian captivity, including the first portion of the Medo-Persian Empire beginning in 539. So even during Daniel's day, he would have seen Zerubbabel lead a return of Jews back to Israel in the first year of King Cyrus. And we read in chapter 10, verse 1, that Daniel was alive at least until his third year of being king in 536. So you can see how that all works out. But to set Daniel in a certain time period in our minds, about this time, there were certain things that were happening in secular history. So the construction began on the Acropolis in Athens, Greece. The Mayan civilization was currently flourishing in Mexico, although it wasn't called Mexico at that time. Aesop was writing his fables. So if you're like me, you know, growing up on Aesop's fables. Confucius and Buddha lived during this time. Greek art began to excel. The Greeks introduced the olive tree to Italy. The Phoenicians also made the first known sea journey around Africa. So those are some notable things that were going on about this time. The writing takes place in Babylon. And so let's take a look at ancient Babylon and consider the magnitude and size of the city. If you look at this picture here, those are some ruins from the old walls of Babylon. Another picture here is of the Ishtar Gate, and it still stands today. You can see a human right here, and actually if you go back one, you see a human here to give you a sense of the scale. This human is in front of that and also uphill to that gate. And this corner right here, we would be looking at the corner of the gate right here. And then the next picture shows you a model of that gate. And so it would have been an astounding city with an amazing main gate going inside of it with huge walls all around. Now, Babylon was originally founded by a man named Nimrod. If you've heard of Nimrod from the Bible, he dwelt in the land of Chaldea on the Euphrates River in modern-day Iraq. He built several towers in his day. One particular tower was very notable, wasn't it? It was the Tower of Babel. It was an outward manifestation of his inward rebellion against God. And so Nimrod welcomed pagan religions, catered to the occult, promoted gross immorality and prostitution associated with all these pagan systems. And he had many city-states that were eventually merged together under his control in Babylon. And because of the widespread evil and the paganism and the sexual immorality there, Babylon has been called over the years the mother of all harlots. Because of Nimrod's love of big government, the city is also recognized as the beginning of world government. So if you wonder where false religion comes from, Babylon. You wonder where big government and even world government comes from? Babylon. And so today, ancient Babylon is really a heap of ruins because God judged it for being so harsh to his people. But Babylon, biblically speaking, will be rebuilt once again. It's prophesied that Babylon will become a great global trade center and a hub of one world global religion, because Revelation 18 says that it is going to happen and God is going to judge it. He's going to judge religious Babylon and commercial Babylon, and it will all come down and be destroyed in one day. One day. So when we think about the book of Daniel, Some might ask, well, why is it important? Why should we be studying this Old Testament book that was written so long ago, 2,500 years ago? Well, listen, the main purpose of the book of Daniel is to give hope to God's people by revealing God's sovereign plan for them, even during Gentile domination. I don't know, is there anyone in this audience, in this group, that could use some hope under Gentile domination this evening? I certainly can. We find out in the book of Daniel that God's eternal program will not be deterred. Daniel repeatedly emphasizes God's sovereignty and the power of God over human affairs, even very, very powerful religious or leaders, government leaders. Daniel 4:25 says, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." And so this is the God who directs the course of human history, and he doesn't desert his people even when they were in a 70-year time out and captivity in Babylon. So even though they faced that, as we'll talk about, God was still with his people. He still had a plan for his people. And so they, even though they're in captivity, they must continue to trust in God because of his promises of preservation and ultimate restoration are as sure as the coming Messiah. I want to talk for just a moment, and we will get into the book of Daniel, believe me. But I want to talk for just a moment and show you a chart about how Daniel compares to other books of the Bible. And so take a look at this chart, and then specifically, we want to see how it compares to other prophets during this time. So this block here would represent the book of Daniel. Notice it begins at the start of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. I think my laser pointer battery is dying. Just pretend I'm pointing. And then if you look all the way at the bottom, you see that Jeremiah overlaps the ministry and book of Daniel by about two-thirds. And the book of Ezekiel takes place entirely during the time of the captivity. And then you come here to the end of Daniel's ministry. You see the kingdoms change. He overlaps into the first couple years of the Medo-Persian Empire. And you come down here, the Jews are starting to go back to Israel from their exile. This is when we see Zerubbabel depart with the group. And then we also would have Ezra about this time. And then shortly after that, the book of Nehemiah. And then we also have Zechariah and the book of Haggai. So this kind of helps us put it into perspective just a little bit. Now, the other thing that I like to do is I like to look at the outline of these books that we jump into. And so if you look at this outline, which will be in your handout, by the way, the print is kind of small here. The most important thing to understand is that the first seven chapters, they deal specifically with Daniel interpreting other people's dreams. And then chapter 8 through 12 has to do with an angel, a messenger of God, interpreting the dreams that Daniel had. Another contrast is you have historical narratives versus predictive narratives. And again, the other dividing point in the book of Daniel is that the first half deals with the Gentile kingdoms, whereas the latter portion deals relatively with Israel and the Hebrew nation. And so this will be in your handout later. So let's take a look at the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, we see his personal life, his background, how he came to be in Babylon. And it says this, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Daniel's name, his Hebrew name, is beautiful in its meaning. It means God is my judge. God is my judge. And isn't it true that God judged Daniel as righteous as this one that he appointed to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's palace? And you look at the Hebrew names of these young men that went with Daniel into the captivity. Hananiah means beloved of the Lord. Mishael would be related to Michael, which means who is like God. Azariah, the Lord is my help. But Daniel purposed in his heart, verse 8, that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And so this is really something that characterized Daniel's life, where God gave Daniel the courage he needed to stand up in the face of difficulty. And in this case, he needed courage to object to the food forced upon him by the Babylonians, and it was probably against the Jews' strict dietary laws, okay, that they said, you know what, we're not going to defile ourselves with these delicacies. And so what Daniel does is he proposes a 10-day fast to prove that his choice of food was healthier than the king's choice. And after 10 days of only water and vegetables, their appearance was far better than that of all the other young men who ate the king's delicacies. And so God began to show these young men favor in the palace of the king. Drop down to verse 18. Now at the end of the days when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. And so God gave them brains. He gave them smarts, and he gave Daniel courage. He gave them knowledge beyond their years. And this would be important, especially as we see in the coming chapters. In chapter 2, we see the radical nature of King Nebuchadnezzar. He has a dream, and he tells his magicians or his astrologers and sorcerers to tell him not only his dream, but also the interpretation. And evidently, they had spoken lies and gave corrupt interpretations before, and the king had figured out that if they had the power to interpret the dream, then they should also have the power to discern the dream or the vision as well. So he's putting his own guys to the test. And what happened was, as he said, if you don't tell me what I dreamed and the interpretation of the dream, you're going to die. That's serious. And in verse 13, that decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. And so he was included in this. And they set their hearts to pray to God. And God gives Daniel the dream and the interpretation, which he tells the king. It's always good to pray. But especially when facing death, that's a really good time to pray to the true and living God. I love verse 17. Daniel hears about this decree that goes out, and he tells the messenger, you know what, just give us a little moment, let me talk to my guys. Then Daniel went to his house, and he made the decision. Oh, verse 16, sorry. So he went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. What does he have to lose if he's going to die anyways? Like, hey, give me some time, I'll tell you the interpretation. Then he goes home, and he tells this to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, that they might seek the mercies from God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. They were already killing people. I mean, that's the seriousness of this situation. And so down in verse 32, Daniel ends up telling Nebuchadnezzar the very dream that he had. O king, here's your dream. This image, is, you had a dream of a statue. It was great in splendor and awesome, and the head was made of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its bellies, a belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched this while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and the silver and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And so he tells the king what his dream was of this great multi-metalled statue and what happens with this stone that is cut without human hands, comes in and breaks the statue apart, and it becomes like chaff and is blown away, and the stone becomes a mountain that fills the earth. Well, then we get the interpretation in verse 36 all the way down to verse 35, and he says, this is the dream. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom of power and strength and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he's given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings of the toes, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Wow. And I bet Nebuchadnezzar was wowed, because he had never had a sorcerer or a spiritual person in his kingdom tell him the dream and the interpretation. And it wasn't some show or game. This was from God declaring the future kingdoms that would come down history's lane. Four kingdoms, beginning with the Babylonians, and then the Medo-Persian Empire, then the Greeks under Alexander the Great, and then the Romans. We see these 10 kings. We see the 10 toes, the 10 horns mentioned in Daniel 7:20 and Revelation 13 and 17, out of which a small horn comes up and immediately takes out three. Of course, the small horn is the Antichrist, but just file this in your brain when you're comparing Daniel to Revelation. The 10 toes of the statue are the 10 kings and are the 10 horns. So the ten, it's all speaking about the same things. He's talking about this revived Roman Empire that will be kind of strong with the iron and kind of fragile with the clay, right? A revived Roman Empire, and we see that starting to take place in Europe right now. It's rather interesting, but it's out of that ten-toed empire that the Antichrist comes. I mean, He's laying out, God is laying out for us world history right before King Nebuchadnezzar. If you look down at verse 47, the king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." And so he ends up promoting Daniel and his friends. Well, then in Daniel chapter 3, we see the classic story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, right? It's not really Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace, although it is. We know it by their pagan names. But what happens is Nebuchadnezzar, interestingly enough, after he has this dream of a giant multi-metalled statue, he erects a very large statue, a very tall one, representing him, and he commands all people to bow down and worship this golden image. And it's not multi-metalled like the vision. It's all gold. It's all about him. So even in that, he's defying God. He didn't even try to build a statue like he saw in his vision. It's fascinating. So instead of making it like the dream, he makes it all about him. And then something happens. As this concert is going on, kind of a Woodstock situation, the band is playing and people are bowing down before this huge, huge statue. He gets word that Daniel's friends are not worshiping the idol, and he's furious. Now, he likes these young men, and so instead of just lopping off their heads, which you would have expected with a dictator king like this, he invites them to come forward, and he says, basically, "What is it that I hear that when the music plays, you do not bow down and worship this image as I've commanded? What's going on?" Let me just say that we're going to try this again. When the music plays, he gives them a second chance. When the music plays, you're going to bow down and everything is going to be good. I like you boys. So when the music starts up again, bow down and worship the image. So in verse 15, he says that. If you're ready at the time that you hear the sound of the symphony and everything, and you fall down and you worship the image that I've made, good. But if you do not worship, you'll be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Oops. That's not good, Nebuchadnezzar. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, king, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And so they are thrown into the fire and are met by one appearing as the Son of God. King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 24, was astonished, and he rose in haste, and he said to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they answered, and they said to the king, "True, O king. Well, look, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So Jesus meets these young men in the midst of the fire. This was their greatest trial in their entire lives. And Jesus meets them right where they are in the midst of the fiery furnace. And you know what? You can't, it's almost like you can't put the fruit any lower to pick that Jesus will meet you in your fiery furnace. You might be in one right now. You might have come out of one and you realized that Jesus will meet you in the fiery furnace. You might be about ready to go into one. Well, guess what? Jesus will meet you in the fiery furnace. These young men, they were thrown into the fiery furnace bound. And Nebuchadnezzar sees them free walking around. Did you know when they came out, they marveled and they said, their hair is not singed, their clothes are not burned, they don't even smell like they have been smoking or were in a furnace. They didn't smell like smoke. And you guys know it too, right? When you come back from camp or one of your family members comes back from camp, it's like, "Oh, you guys had a fire, didn't you? Yeah, we did. And you got to wash those clothes, get the smoke smell out. But here's the truth, is the only thing that burned was that which bound them. The only thing that burned was that which bound them. And I'll tell you, you stand up for the truth. Sometimes it's going to be fiery. Sometimes it's going to be fiery. Look how upset Nebuchadnezzar was. He got so angry, he heated up the furnace 7 times hotter than normal. It was already a furnace for melting stuff. 7 times, what good is that going to do? He was hot. He was very, very angry. He was burning up inside. But you stand for the Lord, and people are going to get upset. They're going to get upset, but Jesus is going to meet you, and Jesus is going to turn what is meant for evil for your good, and you'll come out better on the outside than when you went in. Pretty cool. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. I therefore make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." And he promoted them once again. And so you kind of see how fickle Nebuchadnezzar was at first. "Who can deliver you from my hand? Bow down to my image, ha ha." And then finally he's like, "God is the God of gods. You know, if we're going to do great harm to anyone who rejects this." When I read this, there's no other God who can deliver like this, and how they trusted in him, they frustrated the king's word, and God delivered their bodies from the fiery furnace. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, he says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." I wonder if Paul was thinking about Daniel 3. It didn't have a chapter association with it, but this section of Daniel when he was writing Romans 12:1. Is it possible? It's possible. So he promotes these three Israeli youth, and then, well, some people have asked, where was Daniel? It's guaranteed that if Daniel was in Babylon, he would not have bowed down just from an understanding of the character that Daniel had, who he was. And so the assumption is that Daniel, in his position in Nebuchadnezzar's government and his place, that he was away at this time on some kind of official business and was not in the area. I guarantee Daniel, who was a righteous man, would not have bowed down. So he probably, most likely, just wasn't even there. Chapter 4, the king has another vision, but this time it has to do with him. It has to do with his pride and with his arrogance. And Daniel interprets the vision regarding the humiliation of the king. And Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom in the vision, it would be cut down to the root, but it would be restored if he humbled himself. And this all came upon the king 12 months later. And in verse 30 of chapter 4, as the king was saying basically, "I sure have done a good job building Babylon with my power and my might and my majesty," God says, "The kingdom has departed from you." And it all happened exactly like God had revealed through Daniel. Verses 34 through 37 speaks of the amazing restoration of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 5, there's a number of people who ruled from Nebuchadnezzar's time to the next king of the Medo-Persian Empire. There's a guy named Nabonidus, and then Belshazzar was his son or co-regent, and then Belshazzar, he's the focus of this chapter 5. In verses 1 through 4, we read that he was partying, and it was a debaucherous party. Is debaucherous even a word? It was a party filled with debauchery. It is now. Thank you, brother. But he was partying with the vessels taken from the temple in Jerusalem. And while he was doing that, God interrupted the party. And we see that in verse 24. There were fingers and a hand that were sent from God. And there was writing on the wall, and this is the inscription that was written, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin." That's not good if God interrupts your party and writes these four words on the wall, which means numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided. It's as if God is saying to Belshazzar, your number has come up, and it's not good, like you're waiting in line to get a driver's license. Your number has come up because you're going to be judged. You've been weighed. You've hung on the scales of judgment, and you're found wanting, and your kingdom is going to be divided. Verse 26, this is the interpretation. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. The kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now it was Cyrus the Persian who conquered the city, but apparently, he reigned with Darius the Mede, as you can see if you're taking notes in chapter 6 and verse 28. Okay? So that's why, after the Babylonian Empire, it was called the Medo-Persian Empire. You see how each metal is a lesser metal. We've gone from gold to silver, right? If you'd rather have an ounce of gold or an ounce of silver, what would you want? Gold. And so it was one ruler of the Babylonians, now it's a shared rulership, the Medo-Persian Empire. It's weakening. It's weakening. Now, chapter 6, this is one of the most read and loved chapters of the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 6. After Daniel is promoted, a trap is set by Daniel's enemies. Darius signs a foolish decree to have people only pray to Darius for a period of 30 days. And Darius thinks, oh, that's a good idea. Like, he's flattered by these, you know, rulers of his. I mean, could you just imagine, king, what do you think? We want you to sign this decree right here. People can only pray to you for a period of like 30 days. We think you're that important. And he thinks, yeah, that's good. But what they were doing is they knew that Daniel would never pray to Darius, and he was only going to pray to the true and living God. So Daniel doesn't go with that, continues to pray to God three times a day. And then there's an interesting thing about the law of the Medes and the Persians. And it states that any law that the king establishes and signs into law cannot be changed. He cannot abolish his own law. So again, we see the weakening of this. A weaker kingdom. Silver is inferior to gold. And Darius now, when it comes to his attention that Daniel has been praying three times a day towards Jerusalem to his God and hasn't been following the decree, he likes Daniel a lot. And so now Darius is very, very upset because he can't reverse the decree. And so he has to put Daniel in the lion's den, lest the liberal rulers of the kingdom begin impeachment proceedings against Darius, or something like that. Well, you know history. Daniel prays, and the mouths of the lions are all stopped. Could you imagine that night? He goes in there, and he was a man just like you and me, prays to God. God stops the mouths of the lions. He's in there all night, maybe snuggled up to the lions. Maybe they were keeping him warm. That'd be pretty cool. But in this chapter, God gave Daniel not just courage, as we saw in chapter 1, brains and knowledge, in chapters 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 with dreams and the handwriting, but But God gave Daniel a heart to worship him alone. He refused to worship idols or pray to anyone else, even if it meant being thrown into the lion's den for failing to do so. And you see, there's consequences for doing the right thing. Doing the right thing is not always the easy thing. A lot of times in the near term, compromise is the easy thing. Going with the flow is the easy thing. But what is the right thing to do? The right thing to do is what God would have us do, to honor him, to look to him, okay? I love Daniel's heart. And I tell you, you go through the book of Daniel, and you realize, as with other portions of the Bible, that there are colloquialisms that come from the Bible that a lot of times people don't know where they come from. Have you ever said, well, I'm going into the lion's den at work today? That comes from Daniel, right? Or, like in the previous chapter, when the writing is on the wall and that very night the kingdom was handed over, what do we hear? Oh, yeah, the writing was on the wall. Like, we saw that coming. That comes from Daniel. Isn't that amazing? The writing's on the wall. It's coming. It's going down. And so the life of Daniel is a great example of how God can really equip you with everything you need to make it through tough times and not really just get through, but be an overcomer if you depend on God like Daniel did. Do you remember how the Wizard of Oz gave Dorothy's friends, you know, what they needed, all that stuff? Well, Daniel could ignore the little man behind the curtain because he depended upon the God of heaven. Chapter 7, we see that Daniel has a dream of four great beasts. An interesting chapter. Take a look at this chart. See if my thing will work here. We have a couple other of his of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We see the fulfillment of the statue, but then we also see this new dream in chapter 7 of four beasts, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a very ferocious and diverse beast. Now notice this chart, it all corresponds with Nebuchadnezzar's statue, the multi-metalled statue of chapter 2, and all of the different world powers that we see happened exactly like God said. The Babylonian kingdom turned into the Medo-Persian kingdom, and then it was the Grecian kingdom, and then the period of the Romans, all the way to the revived Roman Empire from which comes the Antichrist. Interesting. So that's what's going on in this chapter. And one of the things that I mentioned before is that the toes are the same thing as the horns, is the same thing as the kings. And so you see that the legs, the feet, and then you have the horns over here. So just keep that in mind. They're all speaking about the same things. Verse 8, he said, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great, pompous things. Daniel wanted to know about this beast, and he asks one of the angels, you know, what is this going on here? He's actually having a vision of the coming Antichrist after all these subsequent kingdoms. He asks this angel, what's going on? And down in verse 23, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all the other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. Listen to this. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and the law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This summarizes the Roman Empire that was revived into a 10-king empire, right? The toes that were mixed with iron and clay. So some of the strength of the old Roman Empire, and there was weakness in it. And then out of the 10-toed revived Roman Empire comes the Antichrist during the 7-year tribulation. And then we see the judgment and then the millennial kingdom afterwards. Now, this isn't all of what the Bible has to say about future prophecy, but it certainly is a lot, all the way back in Daniel. Now in chapter 8, Daniel has a vision of a ram and a male goat, and these represent the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire. Now how can I speak so boldly about this? How can I know unequivocally that that's what those two beasts represent? Because the angel Gabriel tells Daniel exactly what those beasts are. That's the interpretation. Check this out. Look at verse 20 of chapter 8. He says to Daniel, "The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king." Who is the first king of the Greek Empire? Alexander the Great, a person of history. The four horns that come later, "As for the broken horn and the four horns that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its own power." The four horns are the four generals that ruled right after Alexander the Great. The little horn mentioned in verses 9 through 12 refers to a near fulfillment of prophecy in the person of a wicked, wicked, wicked man named Antiochus Epiphanes. Have you heard about him? Now, we don't have time to get into the many details here that are really interesting, but the little horn that he's talking about here has its near fulfillment in Antiochus Epiphanes and has its far and final fulfillment in the Antichrist. When we talk about biblical prophecy, it's not uncommon to have a near fulfillment and a far fulfillment. And this is one of those occasions. After Alexander the Great died, the Greek Empire, as a matter of history, was divided into four parts. Israel was given to the Ptolemies of Egypt, who ruled about 100 years. And from 175 to 163, control was given to the Seleucids, and Antiochus Epiphanes attacked Israel. And ultimately, he desecrated the temple on December 13th of 168 BC by slaying a pig on the altar and dripping the bodily fluids of the pig all over the altar and all over the inside of the temple, just desecrating it, because he knew about the dietary laws of the Jewish people, and he wanted to just stick it to them as best as he could. Well, what did this prompt? When he did that, it prompted something in history called the Maccabean Revolt. Have you heard about the days of the Maccabees? And so it's called the Maccabean Revolt because Judas Maccabeus wages successful guerrilla warfare, and the temple's rededicated December 25th in 165 BC. Jesus actually attended this feast. They had a perpetual celebration called the Feast of Dedication or the Festival of Lights when they relit the menorah, and they didn't have enough oil, but it stayed burning all night. It was miraculous. And so Jesus actually attended this Feast of Dedication that wasn't necessarily commanded by God. But John 10:22, now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter, and Jesus attended that festival. In verse 26, we read, "The vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future." That particular vision at that time was sealed. It was for the future. Well, guess what? Today, vision and prophecy is not sealed. It's open because we're in the last days and things are happening before our very eyes. Even in the book of Revelation, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. So it's not future any longer, the time is near. And also it's not sealed. Revelation 22:10. And he said to me, do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. So that's John's instruction. At the end of the first century, don't seal this book because the time is at hand. If the time was at hand in John's day, how about now? Oh, man. Chapter 9, prophecy of the 70 weeks. This is a major passage that we need to understand concerning Bible prophecy. And I'll tell you, people who are confused about Daniel chapter 9, they end up being confused about other prophecies regarding the end times, like the millennial kingdom and the tribulation. And if they get this wrong here, then oftentimes they also have Israel and the church wrong, and they think that the church has replaced Israel and God has finished his plan with Israel, which is absolutely not true. And so if you understand this and can continue to grow in this chapter, I like to see it as a framework for end time prophecy. Okay? Pretty cool. If you look in verse 1, verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord, given through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So remember, Jeremiah's ministry went into Daniel's ministry. Daniel's in captivity. He's reading maybe one morning, he's having his coffee or whatever tea, and he's reading through Jeremiah, and he realizes, reading the passages in 25 and in chapter 29, that God determined Israel to be in captivity for 70 years. He considers the time, looks at his watch or sundial or whatever, and he realizes 70 years is almost completed. And then he starts praying that God would do exactly what God said he would do. Now, why a 70-year captivity? A 70-year captivity was necessary because the Jews had neglected to give the land its Sabbath rest every seventh year. And they did this, or they didn't do that, for 490 years. So how many years did they owe the land? 70 years. And God said, my land will get its rest. But also God put them in captivity because of their rebellion and because of their idolatry, all right? Daniel knows it's coming up, and so what does he do? Beginning in verse 3, he starts to pray to God that God would do exactly what God said he would do. And he says, basically, I want to be used by you, God. I want to be a part of what you're doing. And that's what real prayer is all about. Prayer isn't about getting our will done. Prayer is about getting God's will done. And that's what Daniel is doing in this passage. In verse 5, he includes himself. He confesses Israel's sin. We have sinned against you, okay, as a nation. In verse 16, O Lord, according to all your righteousness, I pray, let your anger and your fury be turned away from your city, Jerusalem, not New York City, Jerusalem, your holy mountain, because of our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers. Jerusalem, your people have become a reproach to all who are around us. Does that sound Jewish to you? Absolutely. This whole prophecy here is Jewish. So while he's praying and interceding for the people, the angel Gabriel shows up. This is the same Gabriel that shows up in the beginning of the Gospels when God decides to get his Messiah program going. Remember? Same angel, but this angel is going to be a part of the prophecy of the coming Messiah. So cool. He wants Daniel to understand this. God wants us to understand this, as we find in Matthew 24, verse 15. He says in verse 23, Daniel, at the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved, and therefore consider the matter and understand the vision. Jesus told us to understand this vision. Okay? Whoever reads, let him understand the vision spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Jesus told us to understand this one. Verse 24, here it is. This is pretty amazing. I'll have you out of here by 8. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to do a number of things: to finish the transgression, make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness and seal up vision and prophecy and anoint the most holy. This is the scope of the vision. Let me ask you this. Is vision and prophecy fulfilled and sealed up and completed right now? No. Are you dwelling in a time where everlasting righteousness has been ushered in? Do you guys feel like you really dwell in a righteous time right now? No. So even if you can argue that some of these things have been fulfilled, we know that they all haven't been fulfilled. Are you guys with me? So the middle one, to make reconciliation for iniquity or to make an end of sins. Some people would argue, well, isn't that what happened when Jesus died on the cross? Maybe, but to make an end of sin? There's still sin going on, okay? I'm still falling short. You're still falling short. Okay, so this is future. And then in verses 25, 26, 27, this is this prophecy. And here's what he says. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, so 69 weeks total. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, which is also after the seven, so after the 69 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off or die, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end of it shall be with the flood until the end of the war desolations are determined. Then he, the prince who is to come, speaking of the Antichrist, shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, one time period, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Now this is an amazing prophecy, and we could literally spend the entire evening going over the prophecy, okay? But when he says, from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there are 69 weeks or units, okay? So when was the command that was to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? It was the decree that Artaxerxes gave to Nehemiah in Nehemiah chapter 2 and 1 through 8. The other decrees have to do with rebuilding the temple. That's the only decree that has to do with restoring and rebuilding Jerusalem. And then the other thing we have to determine, if he's talking about weeks, what is that all about? Well, it's a heptad. Well, we have a heptad. Well, let me back up. It's called a heptad or a shabuah, which is a measurement of time. So we have a week of days, don't we? How many days are there in a week of days? 7. Okay, so we have 7 as far as our time consideration. We have a decade, that means a group of years, right? Well, they also, at this time, they had a week of days, which is 7. They also had a week of, of years, which, a week of years, which would be 7 years, a period of time, okay? So he's saying, for the whole vision, 70 sevens are determined for you and your people. He's given them the whole scope, 70 sevens of years. So he says, 490 years I'm giving to you. And then he gives us the division. We're not making it up. He says, there's going to be from the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there's going to be 483 years. Well, my friends, There was a man named Sir Robert Anderson, and he wrote a book about his research in a book called The Coming Prince. And he took the prophetic year, and he said, well, okay, if it's 483, because that's 490 less seven, right, one more group of sevens, you multiply that by 360, and you account for leap years, and then if you go from BC that counts down to zero, and then it starts counting up, if you get to BC one, there's 1 year and then zero, and then so they accounted for all that. You have 173,880 days. And so what he did was, is he was able to realize that the decree of Artaxerxes to restore and rebuild Jerusalem came from his throne on March 14th, 445 BC. He counts forward 173,880 days, and he comes to April 6th, 32 AD. Now, why does that matter? Because on April 6th, 32 AD, there was a man riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, fulfilling Zechariah 9:9 that says, behold, Jerusalem, your king comes to you lowly, riding on the back of a donkey. And it's right here in Daniel. Wow, is right. It's amazing. And so when you look at this, it also prophesies that there's a gap. So you got the Messiah, the prince. So Jesus comes and he was cut off, right? He died, but he didn't die for himself. Who did he die for? He died for you and he died for me. And then it talks about the Antichrist. Do you remember all the kingdoms? The last kingdom is the what kingdom? The Roman kingdom. And then he says that the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. What group of people destroyed the temple and Jerusalem? The Romans. What revived kingdom does the Antichrist come out of? A revived Roman Empire. So he's talking about the prince who is to come is the Antichrist. It's just, are you guys amazed at this? This prophecy is so rich, and it's really remarkable. And so Jesus fulfills this prophecy to the day on Palm Sunday 2,000 years ago. This prophecy is called the prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel. But if the 69 weeks were completed on Palm Sunday and we're in this gap period, because the Antichrist is not on the scene, Paul tells us that, the Antichrist hasn't confirmed a covenant with Israel for 7 years. That hasn't happened yet. That'll happen after the church is removed, we understand from the New Testament, for a number of reasons. And so we're waiting for the 70th week. That, be reminded, it's all Jewish. It's Jewish. One of the things that God does, aside from pouring out wrath and judgment upon a Christ-rejecting world, is he's dealing with the Jewish people. He's going to get their attention. He's going to get their attention. And so that 70th week of Daniel, that seven-year time period, is also called the tribulation. The tribulation. So look at this chart. This will be in the notes as well. You can see how everything lines up with the great image of chapter 2 and the four beasts of chapter 7 and the two beasts of chapter 8 regarding Antiochus Epiphanes and the 70 weeks in chapter 9. And you've got the 1 week there, the last, you know, aspect, the rule of the Antichrist. And it's a remarkable, remarkable passage, to say the least. And I'd love to spend more time on it, but we're rolling now. Chapter 10, Daniel's fasting for 3 weeks. He's trying to figure out, and he's noodling through and grinding through this vision that he just got. And Daniel has a vision of a heavenly messenger who appears to be Jesus. And you look down at verses 12 and 13, then there's an angel, possibly Gabriel, like chapter 9 comes to him. And he says, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I have been left alone there with the kings of Persia. Now I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come. So it's an interesting view into this whole spiritual realm where an angel is dispatched, but he's delayed until Michael the archangel comes to help him, and then he finally gets to Daniel to interpret this vision. Verse 14 says it's for the latter days in the future, and that he'll have to go back to fighting the prince of Persia and the prince of Greek, which reminds us of Ephesians 6, where it tells us that there are principalities and there are powers and there are different, you know, domains for this spiritual battle. Chapter 11, continuation of what the angelic messenger started to communicate in chapter 10. And chapter 11 really focuses on the rule of the Greek Empire. It spans about 375 years of history. And suffice it to say, two specific rulers at this time in this division of the kingdom under Alexander the Great were the Seleucids, that are identified with the kings of the north, and the Ptolemies, who are identified with the kings of the south. Why does the scripture only focus on two of the sub-kingdoms? Remember, Alexander the Great, his kingdom divided into four parts. It only talks about these two because as these two were battling against each other, whichever one was the stronger one at that time ruled over Israel. And prophecy is Israel-centric, okay? That's why you don't see the United States in prophecy. That's why you don't see, you know, Australia in prophecy. We can't read ourselves into prophecy. Will we be affected by it? Yes, we will. Prophecy is Israel-centric. And by the way, beyond that, Jesus is the spirit of prophecy because it all points back to him. And so this chapter 11, it is amazing and it's complicated, but people have said it's so accurate that Daniel had to have been written after the fact. Well, we know that Daniel was included in the Septuagint Bible. That was the Hebrew Bible translated from Hebrew to Greek that was completed in 132 AD before this happened. Amazing. So there you have it. That's chapter 11. Chapter 12, it speaks of, well, again, if you read through chapter 11 later, you'll realize that there are a number of things also about the Antichrist in there. Wicked, wicked man, wicked ruler. The most wicked ruler this world has ever seen. Chapter 12, look at verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, every one who is found written in the book. This is talking about the tribulation period. It's talking about salvation of the Jewish people. If you're taking notes, you can write down Romans 11, Romans 9, 10, 11, but Romans 11 speaks of all Israel will be saved. They're going to get it. They're going to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They're going to believe on Jesus unto salvation, just like you believe on Jesus for salvation. And Israel will one day be known as a nation that receives Jesus as her Messiah, just even more powerfully than she's known as a nation that has rejected Jesus as her Messiah. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Speaking of the two resurrections, there's a resurrection unto life and there's a resurrection unto death and judgment. And for more on that, you can see our chart online under helpful links, our chart on resurrections. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. If you want to be in a good spot now and forever, trust in Jesus as your Messiah, and you're going to shine. If you really want to shine, turn people away from darkness unto righteousness. Preach the gospel. Share the gospel with people. Be a witness. Then finally, we see just these last couple verses. Verse 4, you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. How about the speed of knowledge going on right now? We can't even keep up with it, just the rate of human knowledge and data. You know, there with the advance of AI, there is not enough power to power what they want to do with AI, which is probably a good thing. And then with the advance of knowledge, they're building data centers. That's the new gold is data. And we know this already, where people are mining your data. They want your data. They want your spending habits because they can make money off of you if they know you. And you're known by your spending habits, right? And so these data centers are going up all over the place, but they require a lot of power. But you look at the right now knowledge just increasing at exponential rates. It's hard to keep up with it. Verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, this is speaking about the middle of the tribulation period, and the abomination of desolation is set up. That's when the Antichrist will go in there and proclaim himself to be above God and all that is called God. He'll desecrate the temple. There shall be 1,290 days, speaking of the latter half of the tribulation. Blessed is he who waits and comes to 1,335 days, but you go your way until the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. It's really remarkable, all the prophecies that are in the book of Daniel. But God, remember, gave this prophecy to Daniel to encourage the Jewish people who were in captivity, and they were wondering if God had truly forsaken Israel. And yet with multiple visions that God gave even to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, God is saying to his people, I'm not done with you. I've got a great plan, you have a future, and you have a hope. And that's the same God that we serve today. Even finishing the book of Jude last Sunday, now unto him who is able to present you faultless before the throne of God with exceeding joy. There's coming a day when you, believer, are going to be presented before God without spot and without blemish. Jesus is able to keep you from stumbling. He wants to, and he's capable of that. He's got a plan for you. He's not going to leave you nor forsake you, okay? So whatever time out or captivity you feel like you're in right now, God has not forsaken you. You might be undergoing some discipline, like Israel, probably, hopefully not as bad as Israel, because that was a long time. You might be being chastised. You know what? If you're being chastised, then God considers you his son. He considers you his daughter. We read about that in Hebrews chapter 13, don't we? Even in the letters that Jesus wrote to the churches, he says, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Hey, if you're being chastened and rebuked, that means that you're one of his. That's really good. And you're thinking, maybe a little less rebuking, Lord, right now in my life. But he's not going to leave you. He's not going to let you down. In whatever kind of trial or fiery, hot thing that you're in the middle of right now, he is with you in the fire. And he is working out something so glorious that when you come out the other side, only the things that were binding you up will be burned. Isn't that a great promise? We're going to pray and then we're going to dismiss because I kept you a little long. So Jesus, thank you for these things. Thank you for the book of Daniel. Lord, help us to just realize these basic truths that you're with us in the fire. You're never going to leave us or forsake us. Lord, that when we obey you, it's going to make other people sometimes very, very angry, but in the end, it will be a glorious witness, Lord. And sometimes they turn around, they turn the corner, just like Nebuchadnezzar did. Lord, help us to honor you all the days of our life, knowing that you have a future and a hope for us. Lord, we realize from the book of Daniel that you have a plan and that you're working out the plan. And Lord, we do confess that you are the great God of history. Lord, I pray that you would meet every single need here and that you would encourage every heart in Jesus' name. And all God's kids said, amen. Amen.